Hello, you're listening to Sean from Galactic Chat, and today I'm interviewing Australian speculative fiction author and international bestseller of 27 novels, Ian Irvine. Welcome to the podcast, Ian.
Thank you very much, Sean. It's lovely to be here.
Now, your next book, Vengeance, is due out in November. It's the first in a new trilogy, and I understand that it's a book that's had a long birthing process. What does it feel like to have it out there?
Well, it feels pretty good, actually, Sean. And in fact, I have literally received the advanced copy in the last 5 minutes. So I've been able to open the envelope and admire the the silky pages and the cover and all that, but I haven't actually even looked at it yet. It's so fresh. It's just arrived. But it has been a long birthing process. It's 3 years since my last epic fantasy novel, which was called The Destiny of the Dead. And it's been a hard book to write, partly because I was also writing other books at the same time. I've a number of children's books, so I was a little bit overcommitted over the last few years. And it's quite hard to write a big fantasy novel unless you can be totally focused on all the time, because such big books, if you get out of the zone of the world and the characters and the story, it's takes quite a bit of time to get back into them.
Okay, no, I think that's understandable. I can imagine it's a little bit easier with short story writing, but yeah, when you have to keep character lines and the feeling that you get for the character in perspective, it gets a bit hard if you're having to sort of put it off all the time. I actually got a sneak peek at Vengeance the other day. The publisher very kind to send me an advance electronic copy. And it strikes me, like much of your work, as a fairly original fantasy. How would you describe it to someone who's grown up reading or watching Harry Potter or even Lord of the Rings?
Basically I write sort of great big fantasy adventure stories. I try really hard not to be influenced by anybody, and that's impossible, of course, because there's some of the towering sort of stories in the genre, like the Harry Potter stories, Lord of the Rings, and George R. R. Martin's books and so forth, are very influential. But I try really hard to, if I see that I'm being influenced by somebody else, I sort of try to rewrite to get rid of that, because I want to create my own stories, and I want to take readers to places that they've never been before. But essentially, this book is called Vengeance. It's the first of a trilogy called The Tainted Realm, and it's set in a world or in a land called Heightspore, which was brutally colonised 2,000 years ago, and the original inhabitants almost destroyed. But now the people of Heightspore are sort of coming to feel that the land is tainted by the way that they took it from its original owners. Now they feel as though the land, now they've got this national sense of guilt and perhaps shame as well, and they also feel, and they're declining in power, and they feel as though the land is rising up against them. This one catastrophe after another, violent volcanic eruptions and the ice is sort of closing in all around this island nation and so forth. So, yeah, I think it is different to books that other people have written. It certainly bears no relationship to sort of Harry Potter kind of stories. The world is a world. I've invented it myself, and it's not based on our world.
Okay. Sort of in line with what you've just outlined there, I've noticed on your website that you indicated that with the three-world cycle, your original fantasy series, you wanted to break from the traditional fantasy mold, and you've just outlined there sort of your reasons for doing so, to make your own world, to be more original. Since then, you've branched into children's fiction, and you've actually done three thrillers or eco-thrillers. I have my own thoughts on what might have inspired Vengeance and the Tainted Realm trilogy, but could you perhaps outline what your inspiration was?
Okay. I think that to sort of really crystallise my inspiration, I've been fascinated by the nature of, I suppose, the nature of political power, and how it can be, the legitimacy of power can be tainted by the way it's assumed. And we've seen a number of examples in Australia, one of which was when Malcolm Fraser took over from Gough Whitlam back in the 70s, and a more recent example is Julia Gillard taking over from Kevin Rudd last year. And both Malcolm Fraser and Julia Gillard seem to be haunted by the fact that they assumed power in a way which sort of didn't seem totally legitimate. A lot of people are very angry about it, and those politicians were quite defensive about it. But ultimately, the whole legitimacy of the Gillard government seems to be tainted by this assumption of power. And I'm not interested in politics, actually, but I've noticed this in other countries as well. It's quite a common phenomenon. It was seen in America with Richard Nixon after the Watergate affair and so forth. And I wanted to translate that to a fantasy setting, to a country where they feel as though they had the right to own this country, but now sort of dark secrets are beginning to emerge about just exactly how sort of foul and corrupt was the means that they used to take this country from its original, quite civilized inhabitants. And I just sort of wanted to imbue this whole nation of Heightsball with this feeling of sort of guilt and shame and also a sense of impending doom that the land was now rising up to throw these people out.
I was thinking, as you were explaining just then, that in some sense it's a very Australian novel, taking into account our history of colonisation.
It could be. I mean, certainly there are parallels in a lot of countries that have been colonised from afar. Although the difference here is that it wasn't a more advanced culture. Like, it wasn't technologically sophisticated British taking over a country from basically tribal people, like it was in Australia or even New Zealand, South Africa, and many other countries. So it was, but yes, there are certain parallels there. I was. In this case, the original country was called Scythe, and the people are Scythians. They were actually a sort of quite technologically sophisticated people. They were not in a modern sense, but they were great miners and engineers and so forth. But they were beaten by a tremendous betrayal, but also because the Heightsballers who came from overseas had what's called majory, and the Scythians were forbidden to use majory. It was something which was basically only used by the king of Scythe, and only in to sort of heal the land itself. So that they were forbidden to use it. Their enemies came in, or their opponents came in and used it and betrayed them and overwhelmed them in this way. So yeah, in essence, you could look at it as consequences of colonisation. Although it's 2,000 years in the past, so it's a long way back.
Changing tack a little bit, Kindles are now being sold in Australian grocery stores. Their cheapest version is set to be released in around about November. How do you think consumer expectations have been shaped by Amazon, and what concerns or opportunities do you foresee with the rollout of cheaper e-readers?
Well, there are certainly concerns and opportunities. The opportunities, first of all, when Kindles were $300 or $400 and iPads are still sort of 500 plus. They weren't really a consumer item. They were really something that was, these e-readers were really basically available to people who had more disposable income. But once they come down to a price of $100 or no or less, then basically anyone can have one. And I imagine that in a couple of years' time, most people will have one in the same way as most people have an iPod and so forth. And I think that will certainly transform the publishing landscape. And you can already see it doing this in the US, for example, even at this stage. Something like 25% of certain books, certain genres, and speculative fiction is one of them, are now going out as e-books. And that's up from sort of maybe 10% a year or so ago. Apple's iPad is, they're selling 50 million of them a year or something like that, 40 million a year. And another couple of years, it's probably going to be 80 million a year. So you can see that in a couple of years' time, there will be hundreds of millions of e-readers around in the world, plus, and add to that probably another 500 million devices like iPhones and other smartphones in which people are already reading lots of books. It's going to transform the landscape. That's good in some ways. It offers new opportunities for selling books. I think the worrying thing though is Amazon's dominance, because Amazon has most of the online book market, or far more than anybody else. They're well known for sort of negotiating very hard on sort of high discounts with publishers, and the more power they have, the more power they will have to negotiate and set prices. But the other thing is that they're just sort of been announced recently, and Amazon is now sort of actively sort of acting as a publisher itself. I mean, they've had a self-publishing thing on Amazon for a number of years now, but they're now actively going out to authors and sort of offering to be their publisher. So if Amazon becomes so powerful, they start cutting out traditional publishers in the way that they've already cutting out a lot of traditional booksellers, I think that would be a worrying development if they come to totally dominate the bookselling landscape, because we all know what monopolies are like. Even if they start out with supposedly good intentions, the urge to take more profit at other people's expense is irresistible.
You've got an excellent series of lessons on your webpage called The Truth About Publishing. With the rise of e-books and the ease of self-publishing, do you see any of that advice change?
Funny you should ask, actually, Sean, because I've just started doing a new edition of The Truth About Publishing, because that one goes back to 2005, I think. And I'm, on my blog, I'm doing a sort of a lesson a day, and so there'll be about 40 of them when it's all finished, about going through, updating that, adding in new sections about new things which weren't really relevant at the time. Social media being one, e-books and self-publishing and so forth being others. I think for the time being, traditional publishing is still the best way to go for most authors. And mind you, there are some well-known authors who dispute this. And you've probably heard or seen stuff by J.A. Conrath, American thriller writer, who has basically said doesn't see any point in being traditionally published anymore. He can make more money by doing it himself and selling his books for $1.99 or $2.99 or whatever. But I think it would be dangerous for the average writer to assume that's the case. I mean, J.A. Conrath is a professional promoter, and he probably spends 70% of his time promoting, which only leaves 30% of the time to write books. I think the best thing anybody can do, any writer can do to promote their books, is to write great books.
Mm-hmm.
And if you You can't promote rubbish. Well, you can promote rubbish if you've got an enormous, unlimited budget and you're the world's best huckster, but you can only promote it for a while. I mean, ultimately, you have to deliver the goods, and the goods in fiction is great storytelling. In fact, there's a quote I write I really like from Donald Marts, who's a sort of top New York literary agent who has also written a number of books, and he said the path to success in writing is simple: please your readers on a regular basis. And so that's what I would say. Yes, there are lots of new opportunities. You can self-publish yourself. If you're a fantastic promoter, you can probably do well at it. But if you're an ordinary person who just wants to write books and knows that you're not a promoter, then I think that basically it's the traditional means of publishing are probably still the best. It is an American phenomenon. It's not... The take-up of e-books is not really as dramatic anywhere else, but that's partly because outside America, a lot of publishers haven't made their books available as e-books. For instance, I've got 12 children's books out in Australia. Only the Runcible Jones ones are available as e-books. The other eight aren't. I don't know whether the publisher has any immediate intention, but certainly it's not. It's less relevant in the children's book market. And I think e-book sales in Australia, last figures I saw, were a few percent, certainly not nothing like 10 or 15 or 20% or whatever. But I think they will certainly rise very rapidly over the next few years. The other thing about e-books and self-publishing yourself is that the number of titles is available in English is going up like a rocket. Like for instance, 5 years ago, I think there were approximately 220,000 titles published in the US per year, and that's not just fiction; that's all kind of titles. But anyway, that was the total number of individual titles published. I saw a figure the other day that said 2010 it was like 2.4 million or something. Because now anybody can write a book and publish it on Amazon. But, I mean, simple arithmetic tells you if the size of the book-buying market isn't changing much and the number of titles goes up a lot, individual titles have got to sell a lot less copies. So it seems to me what's happening is publishers are increasingly picking winners. If they think you're the next Harry Potter, then they put an enormous amount of money behind you, and then books like, they say, the Twilight books sell a huge number of copies, probably more than they would have, much more than they would have 10 years ago. The middle contracts and the bottom contracts even more because there's only so many book buyers out there and they're increasingly buying blockbusters. So it's getting harder, I think. It's getting harder to make a living out of writing, even if your books are moderately successful. I mean, for instance, one of my big fantasy novels, this book, Vengeance, took a lot of work. I'd say it's around about 2,800 hours of work to do this book, which is more than any of my previous books. But then it's a brand new world, so there's a lot of world building and character creation that doesn't apply when writing a series. But to put 2,800 hours in perspective, the average working year in Australia is 1,800 hours. So if you go to work 40 hours a week for your 46 weeks, taking out the public holidays and the annual leave, you work 1,840 hours roughly. So 2,800 hours, a year and a half of work, full-time work. That is a lot of work for one book, especially if they don't sell. And a lot of writers' I've been fortunate that my books have sold, and they've sold internationally as well and done well, but a lot of books don't do well. So you can put an enormous amount of work into a book and write a great book, and for some reason or another, doesn't capture people's attention and sells a few thousand copies. Well, a few thousand copies, you might make $5,000 not much money for that year's work. I hope I'm not sounding a little bit gloomy here. I hate writers who kind of constantly go on about gloom and doom, and because no, I've had a fantastic time as a writer. I love doing it. I love everything about it. And but it is, I think people shouldn't have any illusions that they're going to write a book and become fabulously wealthy and hang out with the celebrities.
Recently, the ABC did a book show with four fantasy writers, and the suggestion was that fantasy had now become mainstream, as in more popular and accepted, as opposed to, say, contemporary fiction or literature. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's correct. Fantasy is still looked down upon, and I'll give you a really good example of that. It's the Sydney Writers Festival. Has sort of 250 to 300 writer guests a year. In some years, there would not be a single fantasy writer there. They're not invited. And if there was one, it would be somebody who was probably an international best-selling writer. So yes, I think it is definitely looked down upon by the literary establishment. It's hard to get reviews. On the other hand, I think it's mainstream in the sense that I know that fantasy has probably 15, 17, 18% of the total fiction market. So it's not quite as, I don't think it fantasy sells quite as many copies as perhaps crime, but it's certainly one of the top three genres in terms of sales. So certainly you couldn't. You would have to say it's mainstream. And I think this is, if we sort of look at how the world has changed over the last 30 years, you can see why. I mean, for instance, if you looked at, say, the top 10 movies in terms of box office in, say, 1970, and I can't name them, I hasten to point out, yep. but I have actually looked at the top 10 movies for box office in 1970, there probably wasn't any of them there that you would really say had a fantasy element. You look at the top 10 movies from, say, 1990, 2000, 2010, that whole 20 or 30 year period, most of them will have a fantasy element. And I include movies like Star Wars, which is kind of more fantasy than science fiction. But I mean, even mainstream these movies these days often have a strong fantasy element. So I think fantasy, in the overall sense, is definitely mainstream, and I think that's helped fantasy fiction become more widely accepted.
You've been an Australian writer of the fantastic for over 20 years. What major changes have you observed in the local scene?
Well, the first change, the status quo when I started writing in 1987 was that it was impossible to get published in Australia writing science fiction or fantasy for the adult market. The only way you could get those kind of books published was writing for children, and people like Isabel Carmody, for example, is a good example. Now, she wrote, I think, her first Ober Newton book, which is clearly fantasy, came out in 87 or 88, and it was published for children. It was in the children's section, and it was 10 years later, you still would have found it there. You would never have found it on the science fiction shelves. The peculiar dichotomy here was that Australians were among the biggest consumers of fantasy per capita in the world. And it was quite common for an English publisher, for instance, to ship nearly half their print run of a new fantasy novel to Australia. And yet none of the publishers in Australia were willing to take a chance on publishing Australian science fiction or fantasy writers. And that really didn't change till 1990, when Martin Middleton wrote a number of fantasy novels, first two or three were fairly successful. Pan Macmillan published them, and then they sort of died away, and so the initial Australian publishing kind of sort of lost impetus until really until Sarah Douglas's book Battle Axe came out in 1995, and that was a big success. It outsold a lot of the big name international fantasy writers, and that kind of spurred the industry on. I was accepted by Penguin the following year, and a number of other writers, Tracy Harding for instance, Kate Forsyth, Cassiel Moore, were sort of published in the sort of mid to late 1990s, and all sort of with tremendous sales and sales that continued on with succeeding books. And so it went from a situation where in the early 90s there was virtually nothing could get published to by the year 2000 that there were probably 50 or 60 Australian fantasy writers, a lot of whom had done really well, and most of those were also being published internationally. So it was really a renaissance, and it was really noticeable overseas. In fact, I was in the UK in 2005, and I just went around all the bookshops looking, adding up the shelf space to good old Aussie authors, and it was like we had about 15% of the total shelf space in sort of every big bookshop in the UK was Australian fantasy authors, whereas if you'd gone into those same bookshops 5 years before, you probably wouldn't have found a single title. So it was a renaissance, and now there are, so 15 years after Sarah Douglas' first book, now there are probably 80 or 90 Australian fantasy writers who've produced one or more novels. At least 50 of those have also been published internationally, some to great commercial success, some to great critical success, some to both, like Garth Nix, for example. So it really was a fantastic period for publishing, I think. I don't know what the future holds. I think, as we were just talking, that everything is changing so rapidly with ebooks and Amazon and our Apple's iBookstore and Google getting into book publishing as well. I don't think anybody can predict what's going to happen in future, but it's certainly an exciting time.
I'm not sure that creatives are ever 100% happy with their work. A veteran after 27 books, what about writing still challenges you?
A number of things. One is trying to make the next book better than the last one, rather than a repeat of the last one. Sorry, just lost my train of thought there for a second. But I don't think writing gets any easier in one sense. I mean, sure, I can. When I write a first draft and look at it, and I think it's awful, and all writers hate their first drafts, as Hemingway famously said, in slightly different terms. But I, being a professional writer, I now know how to fix my dreadful first drafts, how to turn them into good storytelling in the eighth or tenth draft. But it's it doesn't get any easier. But the other thing, the problem that I particularly have is that having written 3.7 million words, I think 27 stories, a lot of those are big fantasy novels, you just use up an enormous amount of a number of plot elements, and you use up an enormous number of characters and scenarios and so forth. So I find it's an increasing challenge to keep my work fresh and original. For instance, when I first started writing, I found it difficult to plot and plan in detail, so I just used to write and I would make it up as I went along. I can't do that anymore because I think if I tried, I would fall into the bad habit of writing the same kinds of characters over and over again and the same kinds of situations. So these days I've changed my writing style completely. I now plan my books in intricate detail. I might do a a sort of 30 or 40 page scene by scene outline for the entire book, so that then I can go through it and say, this is repeating a character I wrote in The View from the Mirror, or this is repeating a storyline or something or other. So I can go through all of that, analyze it, and then consciously sort of change things to make it, to freshen it up. So that's my biggest challenge, is trying to remain fresh and original.
We've recently seen the screen adaptation of George Martin's Game of Thrones to the small screen. Which one of your works would you like to see adapted for film or television?
That's a tricky question. I think probably The View from the Mirror, which was my first fantasy series, or the one that succeeded that, The Well of Echoes, which is also a quartet, an enormous quartet. When I've polled readers on my Facebook page, more of them tend to say that The Well of Echoes is my best series so far. So, I think it is also quite an original series. So, and a fairly visual one. I think that would be good. But also, I'd love to see Grim and Grimmer, my humorous adventure fantasy series for kids, which has just been completed earlier this year. And I had such fun writing that series. It was the best time I've ever had writing in my life. So that'd be nice too. So if you have any influence with international movie producers with a spare couple of hundred million lying around.
Working as a marine biologist, you have some interesting tales to tell about avoiding mad Burmese cooks and having to do surveys in crocodile-infested waters. Will we ever see a non-fiction tale of adventure, or do you prefer to use your life experience as an inspiration for your fiction?
No, I don't think there'll be a non-fiction life. Actually, my life hasn't been that adventurous. I mean, yes, I've worked in a lot of countries around the world, and but most of it hasn't been sort of that exciting. Actually, we've had certainly had some dramatic moments, particularly working in Sumatra. But no, I think I'll stick to fiction. And the trouble with life is that this sort of, who was it said that fiction was life with all the dull bits cut out? I can't remember anyways, but I think if you sort of cut all the dull bits out, my life would actually be quite a short story.
Now, you do drop in randomly and sign books at local stores. Where might fans be able to catch up with you in person, say, for a signing in the near future?
Well, they can catch up with me tomorrow and the next day at Armageddon, but that's way too soon, I imagine. I'm going to be at Armageddon with Expo in Melbourne. In fact, I'm getting a plane down there sort of late this afternoon. I'm also going to be at Supernova in Brisbane on, let me just check, 5th and 6th, I think, coming events. Supernova is on November 4 to 6th in Brisbane, and it's terrific. I can certainly recommend that. I was at Supernova in April. So I'll be back there. I won't be there on the 4th, but I will be there 5th and 6th, which is Saturday and Sunday of first weekend in November. And I'll be on a Dimmock stand there, along with Marianne DePierre's and a number of other good Aussie writers. And that'll be a good place. I don't have anything lined up between that and the end of the year, actually.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you, Ian. Thank you for the opportunity, and good luck with the new book.
Well, thank you very much, Sean. It's been a pleasure talking to you too. I haven't. It's been quite a while since I've done any interviews, and so it's lovely to talk to people about books and writing and all of that kind of stuff. I've enjoyed it very much.